Hey there, welcome to LSAT Demon Daily. I'm Dylan Horowitz. That's my boss, Nathan Fox. What do you have for us today, Nathan?
Well, this came from, so Dylan is, for people who don't know, Dylan is a super valued member of the LSAT Demon team. He responds to ask button requests on every single question. There's, one way to think about it is that there's 10,000 ask buttons within the Demon, right? Because there's an ask button on every single question, and that ask button goes to Dylan's team. That it's a team of LSAT tutors, everybody who scored 99th percentile on the official LSAT. What did you score, Dylan?
177.
Yep. And so Dylan is there responding to questions about individual LSAT questions. And you've been doing that now for how long?
I'm not sure. Last summer, for sure. I don't remember what month exactly, but it's been a while. I've definitely gotten better.
Yeah, 9 months, and you've been doing, like, if this last week is an indication, you've been doing 15 or 20 a day for 9 months. So, you know, there's, like, you've probably done by now thousands of these written responses to students. So you've learned in kind of a unique way. You've learned a lot about LSAT along the way. But this came from one of our students, and we'll keep them anonymous. But it said, hey guys, my question is strategy based. I was wondering if I could get some advice. When I took this practice test, I got to passage 4 with about 5 minutes left. I've been in the same predicament for several practice tests with 5 minutes left. I read the first and last paragraph and try to answer what I can. Would other strategies such as skimming be more useful with limited time? And you wrote a response that we thought was super useful. You did a football analogy. Mm-hmm. Why don't you walk us through that?
Well, the first thing that struck me as odd about this request is that getting to the last passage with 5 minutes left is really good. Like, it's not all the way there, but think of how many students don't even get to the fourth passage, or they get to the fourth passage as, like, time is running out. So if you have 5 minutes, that is a great place to be when starting the last passage, but it's not quite there. And this is kind of the analogy that I used. It's like improving on RC is moving the ball up the field in football, American football. I don't know how many international listeners there are.
Yeah, NFL.
But yeah, the goal is to go score a touchdown and get 7 points. Just like in RC, the goal is to finish all the passages and get all the questions right. So the point that this listener is, or Demon student is at, he's so close. He gets to the fourth passage with 5 minutes left. He only needs to be a little bit quicker on each of the previous three passages to have enough time to really give the fourth passage a good shot. But when he's asking for, like, how do I take a shortcut? Like, just read the first and last paragraph or skim the whole thing.
Yep.
I analogize that to, he got all the way to the 5-yard line. So he's 5 yards away from scoring a touchdown. And now he's asking me, what's the best way to kick a field goal? Or, you know, get 3 points instead of the 7. Mm-hmm. When he worked all the way up to get a touchdown and all that effort, and he's just trying to settle for less. So that was what I wrote back to him. And I think Brittany and you liked that analogy. So here we are discussing it.
Yeah, it's a pretty common thing that people, they're like, well, but what do I do in those last 5 minutes? Because I always find myself in this spot. And it's like, yeah, okay. But listen, you've already spent 6 out of 7 of your minutes, right? You've spent 30 out of 35 minutes. Or I guess if you're an accommodated student, the ratio changes a little bit. But even there, it's even more extreme. It's like, well, I don't care what you're doing. If you have 53 minutes or if you have 70 minutes on the section, then those last 5 minutes, like, that's time for you to answer one question. And even for people who are doing the test in normal 35-minute sections, you shouldn't be worrying about that. You should be worrying about how to deepen your comprehension of the passages in the first place so that you can more quickly dismiss wrong answer choices, so that you can blaze through the questions you know, never think about blazing through the passage and read the question itself carefully and read the answer that you're going to pick very carefully. But the wrong answers, that's where we're going to pick up speed, because you're going to read two words of some of the wrong answers and just know they're wrong. And that's how to go fast. And so when this question comes in from a student who's like, well, what if I just in the last 5 minutes, what if I just skim or read the first paragraph and the last paragraph and then try to answer some of the questions? It's like, I that's just not what we do here. Mm-hmm. Like we only ever talk about strategies that are related to understanding. So what my response would be, and I like your football analogy, because it's like, listen, we teach you how to score touchdowns. I don't give a shit what you do about the field goals. What I would do, though, I mean, I would say, hey, if the 5 minute warning has popped up, you should guess on all the remaining questions. That'll take you 10 seconds. D, 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 D. Go back to what you were working on. And if it's a brand new fourth passage, I think you have to read the passage carefully and then try to get one or two of the questions correct. I do not think that any kind of gimmicky skimming, I mean, there are so many passages. If you read the first and last paragraph and then tried to answer the main point question, I feel like they write wrong answer choices intentionally designed to try to catch people who are doing that bullshit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I feel like an underlying assumption of this question is that they're not going to improve between now and when they actually take the test. Mm. But they control how much time that is. Now, that might mean being flexible on which cycle you're applying and which test you're taking, but you don't have to take the test tomorrow. You don't need to go in at this current level of preparedness. And one thing I think about the LSAT demon that sets it apart, besides the overall philosophy, is that I feel like this is the Gunners LSAT prep company. Like, we're not the ones that settle for less. That, you know where to find that curricula. We're the Gunners who are like going to get every point we can. And, you know, obviously they get a bad rep in law school, but for the LSAT, that's the game.
But they also don't. Like, I think people think that Gunners get a bad rep in law school. You know what Gunners also do? They get A's. they get on campus interviews. Now, I'm not talking about the guy who thinks he knows everything and raises his hand and then gets B's on his gets like a C on his final. Like, that dude in the first semester, you never see him again in the second semester, because he just learns that he's not the shit he thought he was. He's not. That's not the Gunner I'm talking about. The real Gunners, they might not even be raising their hand all the time. They're just like, they did all of the preparation. They have already been working on practice exams from the like very first month of class. They're like doing practice final exams for that class. You know, I did the reading for this week. I also started working on practice exams for 3 months from now. And, you know, they're like in study groups and they're talking about these issues and they're reading supplementary materials and they're like really working their asses off. And they're fully prepared. I like this idea. LSAT prep for Gunners.
I mean, the I only marketing like part of it that doesn't work is the association people have with that word in law school, because you're absolutely right. Like, they get results, but people, they don't see those results. They see the kid that won't shut up in class, which is not who we're talking about.
No, that's not the guy I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the one who's going to eventually get A's on all their exams. You know, that's the one. And that's right. I don't want you to get a B on the LSAT. Mm-hmm. That's not what we're about. Like, there's other prep out there that might teach you some gimmicky strategy for skimming and getting from a 150 to a 157. But I feel like if I helped you get from a 150 to a 157, all I'd be doing is giving you the rope to hang yourself on. Like, you'd end up going to some shitty school. You'd end up paying way too much money to go there. And I want, like, I'm in the business for the long haul. And like, what I want is I want you guys to go become like Supreme Court clerks, you know, like I want you guys to go become law firm partners, judges. I want you to be a fucking senator. Because if you do that, then you will remember where your LSAT prep was and you'll send people back. And I'm not here to like help you barely squeak in and create some unsatisfying legal career, right? I don't want you to impoverish yourself, struggle in law school, struggle with the bar exam, struggle to find work, wash out. I would rather you wait and fully prep for the LSAT, hit a home run. Sorry, mixing too many metaphors, but yeah, I mean, that's what I want. Like, I want touchdowns. I definitely don't want the field goals.
Something that I thought was a platitude when I was starting out was when people would say, this is the first step of your legal career. And I'd be like, I am a college student. I'm studying for this test. This is not my legal career. But the more I understood the test and the role it plays in admissions, I'm like, well, your legal career is advocating for people and helping them navigate this legal system that we have. Law school admissions, you are advocating for yourself. You are your own client. And you are navigating the system of law school admissions. And I'm not a lawyer, but I've talked to a lot of them, obviously. And I feel like you would agree that like the qualities of a good lawyer, like one of them is they will do literally everything in their power to help their client's chance of winning. Like if there's a motion they can file that even increases their chance of winning by 1%, they will do it.
And here, so you're talking about advocacy, right? And advocacy, people always think about arguments, which is part of advocacy. But a big part of arguments, the foundation of arguments, is evidence. And it's a critical part of being an advocate to marshal the best evidence you can. And lawyers do not frequently have the luxury of manufacturing evidence. Now, I guess that's partially what you're doing when you go get witnesses and bring them into court. You know, you're building a record, right? You're creating evidence. And on the LSAT, you have the opportunity to create evidence in your own favor. Like Dylan, do you remember what your first practice test was and how long you studied and all that?
So I didn't take a cold diagnostic because I didn't even know that was a thing when I started. Okay. So I had a little bit of knowledge and my first test was about 160-ish.
Yeah.
And studied for about a year. I saw people above me that were going along the same path. What they would do is they would just start, take a class like their second semester junior year, not do as well as they hoped. And I thought, well, I'm going to give myself more time. I'm going to start the summer before junior year and just have that whole year to study. So then I can take it over the summer or retake in the fall or whatever it is. And I ended up taking about 30 practice tests, not counting like individual sections. I mean, sitting down and doing a full 5-section test, which is what it was at the time that I was studying.
Back in the day. Yeah. That's amazing. I mean, so 160, not really a cold diagnostic. Your cold diagnostic probably would have been somewhere in the 150s. And you end up like with the right kind of prep, with the right kind of strategy, you end up improving from there by 20 points, basically, to all the way up to a 177. And what you've done is you have created this super powerful piece of evidence that cannot be argued with. Like, nobody can say shit about that. The law schools are just going to be like, well, that's above our 75th percentile. Great. Or, you know, if it's like Yale, it's like, oh, well, that's our 75th percentile. Great. Perfect.
And I feel like I'm pretty self-aware. That 177 is why I'm going to Harvard. Like, if I set a goal score at the very beginning, maybe I would have said 170, but I may have thought that was a reach at the time. But I didn't. My goal was to get the highest score within my capacity, whatever that may be. And I'm very fortunate that that turned out to be a very high score. But if I applied with a 170, Harvard wouldn't have even looked at my application. I don't have an interesting story. I'm, you know, middle class white kid. They have enough Jews in law school, so I don't really add diversity. It's really that 177 that unlocked the key. I mean, my GPA was good. It was slightly below median, so technically a splitter. So really, I mean, can't thank you guys enough, because the LSAT demon is why I scored this well. It really is your philosophy that resonated with me and helped me succeed.
You're welcome. You did all the work. I mean, you're the one who like busted your ass for a damn year to create this super powerful piece of evidence. But yeah, I mean, like, people come to us with like, well, I have bad grades. Should I write an addendum to explain that? And also my LSAT isn't that good, so I could write about whatever. And it's like, well, that's one way to advocate for yourself. But a far better way to advocate for yourself is to demonstrate how smart / hardworking you are by doing, I mean, I just really believe that anybody can improve. Like, I don't think it's a stretch to say that, like, yeah, pretty much anybody can improve by 15 or 20 points on the LSAT.
Mm-hmm.
It might take a while, but it will change your life. Like, I agree, Dylan. Yeah. With a 167 and mediocre grades, you're not going to Harvard. I mean, you'd be an exception, right?
Yeah.
You don't want to be an exception. You want to go in through the front door.
Yeah. And I truly think I got in the easy way. I think the LSAT is the easy way. The hard way, the people who don't have like the LSAT score and GPA, who have these amazing life stories where they face like real adversity and like set up nonprofits and like actually change the world already. That seems hard to me. I'd rather just study for this test.
Well, everyone is trying for those few spots of like, well, we're making exceptions, right? I mean, if you look at the 509 data, the GPA and LSAT ranges are narrow. And so, yeah, they are making some exceptions. Like, there are 25% of the class that are admitted with LSATs below their 25th percentile. 25% of the class has a GPA that's below their 25th percentile. That's what 25th percentile means. Mm-hmm. So this is like the 25% of the class that they're willing to make these exceptions for. But the lazy route is to say, well, that's one of those spots. That's for me, right? So you're calling that the hard way. But I do think it's the hard way, because it's a vastly more competitive way. Mm-hmm. Like, everybody thinks they're going to just take the shortcut. Everybody's like, oh, no, just let me in the back door. It's like, yeah, OK, denied. Like, you know, Harvard denies 90% of the applications that they receive. And sure, they want you to apply. And, you know, there are some people who get in via that route. But Dylan, you know, you took I agree with you. It's the widest door. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So in that sense, it's the easiest, but you do have to bust your ass to, you know, get yourself through that door, which you did. Sorry that we have to cut it short. Why don't you wrap it up there?
Yeah. Well, email daily at lsatdemon.com if you'd like to ask us a question or share some LSAT or law school admissions news. Thanks for listening.